Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, I'm Allison Stewart, and welcome to All of It. Three journalists from three respected outlets have been chasing a strange story about internet breadcrumbs, Russian banks, and the Trump Organization. But see, in 2016, just days before the presidential election, Slate published a story by journalist Franklin Foyer that posed a question: was a Trump server communicating with Russia? The main source for the piece was a group of computer scientists who flagged an odd series of communications, or what seemed to be communications, between a Trump Organization email server and a Russian bank called Alpha Bank. The article was criticized by media outlets like The Washington Post and The Intercept. Now, around the same time, The New York Times was following similar leads, but its story was tabled at first. It was published later in a much weaker form. Enter The New Yorker's Dexter Filkins. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist kept at the story, and in this week's edition of the magazine offers about a 7,000-word deeply researched follow-up that attempts to answer many of the questions surrounding this communication, or what we think is, or what they think is, between Russia Alpha Bank and the Trump Organization. Dexter Filkins joins me now. Hi, Dexter. Welcome to All of It.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Sure. I'm going to set the stage a little bit, and then we'll get going. In June 2016, we all learned that the Democratic National Committee had been hacked. Now, enter a computer scientist called Max, who says his job is to, quote, keep the internet safe. How does Max do this, and who is Max?
Well, that was one of the hardest parts of the story. Max is an esteemed computer scientist with an international reputation, and he's part of a group of people with really extraordinary access to the internet worldwide and unique capabilities. That is not his real name. He is very concerned about having his real name revealed. So I had to protect him, and in so doing, I can't. And I wish I could talk a little bit more about him, because he is an extremely interesting guy, and he is the source of the data, and his group was the source of the data back in 2016 for the stories that you mentioned.
Well, can you explain how he and his colleagues keep the internet safe?
Well, what they do, this all goes back to the data which I took a look at. It's mm-hmm. it's the data. It's found in what's called the domain name system, and the domain name system is essentially the architecture for the internet. That's worldwide. The domain name system, also called DNS, it acts like a phone book for the internet. So when you go there and you know, let's say you type in www.cnn.com, that the domain name system will translate that into a many digit number, and then communicate with the computer, with CNN's computer. So essentially, it's like a switching station and a phone book, kind of all at once. And those communications are logged, and that's what they can see. And they can look at a server, like an individual server. In this case, it was a server that was controlled by the Trump Organization, and they can look at the traffic on that server. And that's essentially what we did here.
Now, when did Max and his colleagues get involved in this and got involved in trying to find out who hacked the DNC?
Well, it's an amazing story. Max is a Republican, and so when...
Yeah, you say he's a John McCain kind of Republican, right?
Yeah, he's a John McCain Republican, and I think, in his group, who's a very diverse group, they're scattered around the country, computer scientists. When the Democratic National Committee was hacked in June 2016, when the first reports came out, they got together, and they talk every day. A lot of these guys work with law enforcement. Mm-hmm. They have private clients. They're very successful people. But they said, look, if the DNC was hacked, then probably the Republicans were hacked too. It was probably the Russians, and they probably wanted to, deliver some kind of assessment for Putin on the state of the American election. So let's go look at the Republican servers and see if they were also hacked. And so they went there. They went to the Republican servers. They went to the RNC servers. Didn't find anything, didn't find malware, didn't find any evidence of a hack. So they sort of continued on, and they got to this lone server in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, out in the countryside, and what they found was this Trump server with a very unusual pattern of communications on it.
So what was unusual about the pattern?
Well, that's kind of, you know, this is really, it's like tea leaf reading, because the data, DNS data, it's very limited in what it can tell you. It tells you a lot, but it doesn't tell you everything. And so what they found on the Trump server in Pennsylvania was that the Trump organization had, through an intermediary company, had leased this server to send out mass market emails for their hotels. You know, really basic stuff. Get a, you know, free massage, or a, you know, get two nights, get your third one free. Mm-hmm. In May of 2016, so we're now in the height of the election season, the Trump organization stopped, that server stopped sending mass market emails. And this is when the unusual behavior begins. It essentially stops doing anything. But two entities in the main tried repeatedly to communicate with it. One of them was Alpha Bank. It's the largest private bank in Russia. It's controlled by two oligarchs who are close to Putin. They're both billionaires. The Alpha Bank servers tried to communicate, and that is, they logged a DNS lookup 2,500 times over a four-month period in 2016. So it's extremely interesting. Those are the fingerprints that somebody would leave when they were trying to communicate. And so what the best way to describe this is that when there is a DNS lookup, there's usually communication that follows it. It's an email. It's a web lookup. It's a data transfer. It's a money transfer. In this case, we don't have visibility on the latter. We just have the DNS lookups. But the pattern is very strange. It's why did the Trump server stop sending mass market emails? Why suddenly did Alpha Bank try more than 2,000 times? What was it doing? And so that's the question. I mean, those are the questions that I tried to address in my piece, and what my friend Frank Foer tried to do the same back in 2016.
We're speaking with Dexter Filkins about his new piece in The New Yorker, Was There a Connection Between a Russian Bank and the Trump Campaign? So what you've described is that the Russian bank's server was going up and knocking on the door, essentially, of this
Trump
server, right?
Exactly.
So Max and Company, they told you, quote, "We decided this was a covert communications channel." Did they have any proof, or was this just a matter of them having an educated guess?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that what they first did, and what I tried to do in my piece, was they tried to eliminate every other kind of innocuous explanation. Is this malware? Is this a virus? Is this email? They basically just kind of looked at it, examined the data, the patterns of the data, and decided one thing after the other, it's not that, it's not that, it's not malware, it's not a virus, it's not email. And what they were left with was, and the pattern of the communication, which goes up and down, and it's high some days, low the others, they said this is human activity. This is not an automated computer ping. And so the short answer is, this is what they believe. They cannot prove it, but what they tried to do was reach that conclusion by a process of elimination. The best single piece of evidence that there were human beings involved in these communications happened in September 2016, right before the election. The New York Times, a reporter there named Eric Lischblau, who I've spoken to, was reporting the story. And on September 21st, he took the data, which he had, the same data I had, basically, and he called Alpha Bank's lobbyists in Washington. And he said, look, I've got all this data. There's all this weird computer traffic on Trump's server coming from you guys. What's up? And remarkably, 48 hours later, Trump's server, the domain, vanishes from the Internet. And the New York Times hadn't called Trump. They only called Alpha Bank. And so it looked certainly like, or appears, that somebody at Alpha Bank told the Trump told the Trump Organization that the New York Times had called. So they shut the server down. They shut the domain down. It disappeared. And that's the single best piece of evidence that we have. And you can see it's opaque. It's not direct. It's not 100%. And that's what's been. There's a couple other examples like that of activity which appears to suggest human interaction. Because if it's true, I mean, if we kind of stand back here and we say, what if it's true? Well, then it's stunning. Then you have the largest private bank in Russia in direct communication with the Trump Organization in the weeks leading up to the election in 2016. So that's what the stakes are here. It's a very large and potentially consequential question.
I feel like you've had an audio companion for your story. This would be where a dun-dun-dun comes in.
Yeah, exactly. Hit the music.
So if there isn't any proof of actually direct communication, there's something in your piece that you talk about called foldering, and that perhaps is a way that people or entities are able to communicate but not actually leave a footprint. What is that?
Foldering is really interesting, and it's done all the time, kind of in the covert world. When two people are trying to communicate and not leave, say, an email footprint, typically what they do, or often what they do, is they communicate by drafts. So let's say you call up your Hotmail account and you write a letter in drafts, and you don't send the email. You just leave it in the draft folder. And somebody else who has your username and password on the other side of the world can sign in and read that draft. Again, there's no email is logged because nothing has been sent. He can write his own answer, or she can write her own answer in a draft form, and the other person on the other side of the world can read the answer. And when email is sent, it leaves something called in publicly available computer logs called an MX record, and it leaves no MX record. And that's what happened here. So there is no MX record, but there are DNS records. And so as Max and his colleagues, as they kind of went sifted through the evidence, they tried to come up with theories about what was actually going on. And they are just theories, but the evidence is intriguing and it's compelling in some ways. And so one of them was foldering. They're communicating by drafts. One was maybe they were using some kind of software that was attached to the travel email program, you know, the program that was sending out the mass market emails, and some of these programs have instant messaging. Possibly they were doing it that way. What's interesting, this sounds crazy, but if you remember David Petraeus, then the head of the CIA, he eventually had to resign because he had been sharing classified information with his girlfriend. They communicated over drafts. They communicated by foldering. Terrorist groups have been known to, Al-Qaeda has been known to plan attacks that way. Terrorist groups have been known, this is amazing, they've communicated over the instant messaging software on computer games. And that leaves no MX record. It leaves this tiny footprint called the DNS record, and that's all we have here. So it's you're looking at a big puzzle. This is what I'm doing. I'm looking at a big puzzle, and there's an eye up in one corner, and there's a tail down in the other, and maybe there's a little footprint over here. We have to figure out the rest of it. I mean, you don't have a lot of evidence, and so that's what's so difficult here.
Let's leave that world of the DNS world and talk about the real world, the terrestrial world. We know the Trump Organization has business ties in Russia, and that the president relied on Russia financing for some of his projects when he was not president. Does he or his company have any business relationship with this Alpha Bank?
Not that we can tell. They denied in 2016 when this came out. The Trump Organization, you know, flat denied. I mean, they denied at the time. They denied any contact with Russia. You know, we have nothing there. No contact with the Russians. We know. You know, we since know that isn't true. There were plenty of contacts in 2016, but we know that certainly. You know, many Russians have purchased Trump condominiums, for instance, and they've helped finance projects, etc. We know those things, but Alpha Bank in particular, not that we know of. So it's a mystery. There's a lot here that isn't answered, and that again was one of the real challenges in this piece, was that the data itself is just very, very limited, so you can't answer all these questions.
At this point, do we know if the FBI is investigating these claims or if Robert Mueller is investigating these claims?
We know that the FBI went to the company in Pennsylvania that hosts the server, the Trump server. They went there in October 2016 and picked up the records, which potentially could tell us quite a bit. Presumably, the FBI in 2016 gave those records to the special counsel when it was formed in 2017. Don't know that for sure, but I think it's a pretty good guess. Those records would tell us a lot of things, potentially. For instance, when the New York Times called Alpha Bank in September 2016 and the Trump server, the Trump domain, internet domain, vanished, who shut that down? Those records would probably tell us that. So was it somebody in the Trump organization that did it? And who was it in the Trump organization? Those records would tell us that. And so that would lead, you know, any enterprising FBI agent could go right to the source on that.
You report in your story that the FBI asked the New York Times to sit on some of their reporting. Have you had a similar situation at all while reporting this out?
No, I haven't. Well, the New York Times piece of this is interesting. I mean, I worked at the New York Times for a decade. I love the New York Times. I think it's an irreplaceable American institution, and they've done extraordinary work, since January 2016. But I think on this one, it's interesting because, and I sympathize here. It was a week before the election, or getting closer to the election, as Eric Lischblau was reporting this story, and this stuff is really hard, and it's really difficult to know with great confidence what you're writing. And I think, you know, and the data is kind of by its nature very opaque. And so the Times had this stuff, like a month before the election, and the editor of the paper then, Dean Baquet, who I spoke to, is quoted in the story, basically said, no, we're not gonna do an in-depth story on these computer contacts because we don't know enough about them. We don't know the people on each end who was communicating with whom. We don't know what they were precisely what they were doing, you know, whether it was email or a data transfer or something, or maybe it was nothing. Maybe it was just a computer glitch. We don't know. And it's too close to the election to kind of write a speculative story about that. He's been roundly criticized for that decision. I think it was not an easy call, and so I'm reluctant to jump on the pile there.
But it hasn't happened to you?
Not at all. The opposite. My editor. I spent so long on the story that I can't. Weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And my editor was, you know, go full bore. Turn over every lid and see what's inside and take as long as you need to figure it out and write it all up. So, which I did. I mean, everything that I know is in that story. And I wish, you know, honestly, I wish it were more. It's a fascinating tale. But ultimately we need to know more. And I think the only people who can answer, I think the unanswered questions are somebody who has subpoena power.
Well, I think we only got to talk about 4,000 of the 7,000 words, so people should go read the piece. Dexter Filkins.
A long piece.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Dexter's piece is called "Was There a Connection Between a Russian Bank and the Trump Campaign?" It's in the October 15th issue of The New Yorker. Coming up, a new documentary looks at the public, private, and secret life of Kurt Waldheim, former Secretary General of the United Nations. Stay with us. All of it will be back after the break. This is All of It. Welcome back. I'm Allison Stewart. While serving as Secretary General of the United Nations through much of the 1970s, Kurt Waldheim of Austria was known as the man the world trusts. But he was hiding a secret. And in the 1980s, during a run for Austria's presidency, it was revealed that Waldheim had lied about his whereabouts during World War II. He had, in fact, served as an intelligence officer for the Nazis for much of the war. Yet Waldheim was still elected president of Austria in 1986, spearing protests against him and his presidency around the world, including here in the United States. Here's Tom Lantos, the only Holocaust survivor ever elected to Congress, taking Waldheim's son, who was working at an American bank at the time, to task on the House floor.
This was the central fact of life in the Balkans. This was the pivotal development. This was the focus of activity. And to say that he was too busy with his legal studies in Vienna, it boggles the mind that you would think and he would think that anybody believes it. When Senator Moynihan says that your father is a liar, he speaks for the American people. The American people feel your father is a liar. They know he's a liar.
Austrian director Ruth Beckerman's new film, The Waldheim Waltz, delves into the Waldheim affair. It's currently screening at the New York Film Festival, and it brings Ruth Beckerman to all of it. Nice to see you.
Hello.
So for our listeners who may not remember, how did Kurt Waldheim rise to power?
Well, he was elected in the beginning of the 70s. He was elected Secretary General of the UN before he was an Austrian politician. After the war, he started his career at the Austrian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I think it was at that time that he decided, maybe not even consciously, to hide these 2 years of his life when he served in the Balkans, but made the world believe that he was in Vienna studying after being wounded at the Eastern Front. So nobody checked him, and he rose to the highest office at the UN. Mm-hmm. And only when he was campaigning for becoming president of Austria, an Austrian journalist uncovered this lie and found documents proving that he was at the Balkans and in Greece. And the World Jewish Congress became very active in finding documents and putting out allegations against him.
Why did you call the film The Waldheim Waltz?
Well, good question. Because, first of all, the waltz is a very Austrian dance. And as everybody knows, you turn around and you turn around and you turn to the right side. And I don't know if there's an expression in English, but in German we say, man kann sich herausdrehen. I mean, you can kind of escape by doing another turn, another round, another round. And that was what Waldheim tried. He never admitted to the allegations. He never confessed, but he always tried to find a way out, to sneak out. So
he danced around them.
He danced around. Exactly.
It's interesting, and there's many interesting things about the film. Well, let me tell you, the one thing that's fascinating is you were one of the protesters at the time. And you were filming at the time. Tell me a little bit about your decision to decide to record the protesting and record your own protesting.
Well, it was the mid-80s, the time before internet and satellites. So there was only Austrian TV. And Austrian TV was very much siding with the government and with Waldheim. And they ignored us. So there was this feeling we had to do our own shooting. It was the first time that I had a camera in my hands.
Wow.
I had made films before, but shooting myself. Mm-hmm. And I was really a mixture of protester and documentarist. And I was right in the middle of things. And in retrospect, I regret a little bit that I didn't shoot more. But this was kind of the starting point to make the film when I found this footage again. And I watched it with my son and other very young people, beginning of their 20s, and they were so shocked. Mm. They immediately talked about Mr. Nixon, who was also a liar. I mean, this was before Trump. And so we didn't know that this would be coming up and the film would become so timely. But that's why I decided I wanted to know the broader picture. You know, when you were yourself in the middle of something, you know only a little part of it. So then I started to go into the archives and also in American archives, in British, French archives, to put this affair in an international context of the 80s and of this time when the victims of the Nazis, the Jews, the Roma, the homosexuals, only in the mid-80s, the world started to talk about them, actually. Mm-hmm. A year before, Mr. Reagan went to Pittsburgh to visit SS Graves.
You put that in the
so
film.
Only at that time it became a real scandal. Remember the film Shoah came out in 85. So somehow I felt this is interesting to go into this time period when there was a turning point. Turning points are always interesting for documentaries.
We're speaking with Ruth Beckerman about her new film, her documentary, Waldheim Waltz. It was very interesting to watch Kurt Waldheim react to being pushed, react to difficult questioning by people. Was he a thin-skinned, was he a quick-to-anger person? And why do you think he started to little by little tell people about his past? Because it happened in drip, drip, drips.
Yeah, he danced around. I think he was a kind of course, he was an opportunist. And he was not used to critique. I mean, as Secretary General, he himself says, I was at the highest, my office was at the 38th floor, and nobody was above me. You know, he had this kind of aristocratic, aloof attitude, very arrogant, and he was so astonished that people started to ask questions. So he could not, and he was a very stubborn person. He was unable to say, I'm sorry that I lied in two books. I mean, he had written two autobiographies and had lied about these 2 years in his life. He was not able to put everything on the table, and he never did till the end of his life.
Now, the World Jewish Congress, you mentioned, has played a leading role in uncovering his lies, and it led to some really very ugly anti-Semitism from Waldheim's supporters. It's there's some amazing footage in the film of people making horrific arguments. Am I correct in saying your parents are Holocaust survivors?
Not really. Fortunately, they have not been in camps. They could run away before.
Was it important to you and your family to make this film?
Not really. It was important for myself because I felt so strange to live in Austria and because nobody talked about the real victims of the Nazis. So all of a sudden when this came out, it was also a relief in a way because suddenly the topic was on the table. But I made the film because it reminded me so much about our present times. And we have a right-wing government now in Austria with the extreme right-wing government.
They're tightening asylum laws, putting migration on hold.
And as you say, and the way how they won this election was kind of the same, using the same mechanisms as at the time when the party which had promoted Waldheim used anti-Semitism. Today they use racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, whatever prejudices you find in population, and they won. You know, this was important for me to talk about today, not to give you a lecture in history.
But it's what I love about the film is that you keep it in the era of the 70s and 80s. It's not, you don't have any talking heads or historians now reflecting back. You keep it very much in the moment. Why did you make that choice?
Well, it was a formal choice. I mean, I'm a filmmaker, and I want. And some people tell me this film is like a thriller. We all know that he will be elected in the end, mm-hmm. but still, there's a big sigh in the audience at the end.
Oh, that's
they still accept and they still expect a happy end. You know, that's the power of cinema. Mm-hmm. That was one reason, and the other is that I wanted people to discuss. Of today, about today, I think it's also boring to have the memories of elderly men looking back, and also cheating a little bit about their past. You mm-hmm. know, I thought it's much more powerful to stay just with the footage, constructed in a good narration.
And are you the narrator?
I'm the narrator.
You're the narrator, right? Yes, I thought so.
I'm the filmmaker, I'm the photographer and the narrator.
You've got a lot of actually credit in reviews for your narration, it being very clear and instructive.
Thank you. Didn't read it yet.
Well, there are a couple. Good to know they're very good reviews, and they're very and they appreciate that you were telling a story. And there's a sense of advocacy, but you're not making people have to understand, like, be on your side. You're just clearly presenting it. Mm.
And I look back with a kind of irony and amusement. At the time, I was angry. But today, I think it was good that this thing happened because it finally changed Austria's attitude towards its own past, you know. Today, nobody would say the Austrians were the victims of the German Nazis. And it kind of lifted or broke this taboo of not speaking about so many things. And it was kind of the beginning of civil society. All these people whom you see in the movie who protested against Waldheim, they are still today, they are important intellectuals, artists, and people who just started to speak up and come out of their closet, if you want.
And the final scene is just, it's the best. The final 2 minutes, I'm not giving it away, but it just speaks to who he is and what matters to him in just about 90 seconds of silence. It's perfect. So that's my tease for people to go see your film. Ruth Beckerman, the name of the film is Waldheim Waltz. It's currently screening at the New York Film Festival, and it opens at Metrograph on the Lower East Side on October 19th. Ruth, thank you so much for coming to All of It.
Thank you, Allison.
We'll be back after the break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The name of Sarah Smarsh's new book is Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. It's one of those books that as I've had it and been reading it, I've heard people say, oh, I really want to read that. I heard about that. Now, anecdotally, those people are city dwellers who are maybe curious or who want to understand more about some of their fellow Americans that, frankly, they never really encounter. In the book, Smarsh reflects on her own life growing up poor in rural Kansas. It offers insight and commentary about Americans who have been stereotyped and shut out. And congratulations are actually in order because yesterday Heartland was named as a finalist for the National Book Award. Sarah Smarsh is a journalist who has covered socioeconomic class and politics for a variety of publications, including the New York Times and the New Yorker. Sarah, welcome to All of It.
Thank you so much for having me, Allison.
And congrats on the finalist. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thanks for the lovely introduction. It's an exciting week for me, indeed.
No doubt. This is a question you've answered before, but I know it's important, I think, to the story. You know, some people might think, oh, Heartland, this is a book that maybe she wrote in the past year and a half, given everything that we've been thinking about and talking about. You've worked on this book for years. Why did you want to tell this story? And when was the first inkling you had that you had a story to tell?
Well, believe it or not, and I guess I was a budding writer even at a very young age. And so as a child, I would tell my family, someday I'm going to write a book about you. And I really very strategically made decisions along my professional path so that it might manifest. And that included focusing on writing as an undergraduate. And when I was a senior in college, some 16 years ago, I got my first two research grants to start piecing together the family piece. The story. And so to kind of get at your question about the gestation and development. It really began as a private tale. I understood that there was something unique or increasingly rare about my experience in the American story, or at least what we tell ourselves about our country. And then as I worked as a journalist over the years and was just making ends meet, writing a book, of course, takes resources such as time and money, and I didn't have much of either. As I was making a living as a journalist, I was gaining a language to articulate why the family story might matter in a national way or a public way, and so that those layers kind of were folded in later.
Well, to give people a little bit of background, your father's family, your fifth generation wheat farmers in Kansas.
Yes.
What was, as you looked back on the family, their relationship to their job, what they did, and to their land, and to their place in their local community?
Well, so the culture that I come from is so steeped in just the concept of work. It's a bit of a trope, the idea of the, you know, Midwestern work ethic, but in my experience and my class, it absolutely holds true. So our identity as farmers, you know, connected us to the land, to agriculture in a way that, you know, went back generations, as you said. And my dad is also a construction worker, and that not just, you know, defined his paycheck, but it defined his body in some ways. I write in the book about the ways that the manual labor that I was born to is often just a raw physical experience that shapes your health. And the hell of it is, at the that precise moment, we were not able to access the healthcare system that would remedy those ailments. And so everything about the life is, you know, I think in some more privileged classes, the aspiration would be to that your occupation would somehow reflect your purpose or your inner self and your passions. And where I come from, you're born into your trade, and you have very little of transcending that assignment at birth.
A lot of what you write about is how society told you who you were and who your family were, and your place in the social totem pole, and that shame plays a big part of that. When did you realize there was this element of shame, and did you feel it yourself, or did you just receive it and internalize it?
You know, that's such a well-framed question, because I think, best I can tell, shame, or at least the type of shame that I'm talking about that involves our messages about our economic structure, for me as a child was deeply felt but not really consciously understood. I was a very confident, precocious kid. And even as a first-generation college student at the University of Kansas campus in journalism school, I didn't feel insecure in that setting, even though I probably should have. I was a pretty bold young woman. However, I understand now that there were so many experiences, feelings that I had, that going on absolutely was shame. I had to do.
You know what I mean? You know what, Sarah? You know what? Your yes. ISDN line is cutting in and out, and you're saying great things, but we're catching every third word. So we're going to take about 60 seconds and do some magic on this end, and we'll meet you on the other side. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. I've been speaking with Sarah Smarsh. The name of her book is Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah and I were speaking about how the world tells people who grew up in the circumstances she grew up in who they are. And I want to read a little passage from your book. The books I most identify with as a child were written in the 19th century. I saw many white girls on television, but I barely recognized myself in their stories. When I did see my place or my people, they were usually represented as caricatures. To be made invisible as a class is an invalidation. With invalidation comes shame, a shame that deep, being poor in a place full of narratives about middle and upper classes can make you feel like what you are is a failure. Sarah, I'm going to ask you to continue on when we were discussing about how the outside world makes you feel when you're in your situation.
Yeah, so I was saying that I think that shame is such a difficult emotion to articulate when you're experiencing it in real time. It was really a felt subconscious experience. I presented as a very confident young woman and child, but I see now that I'm older, looking back, that a lot of the feelings that I didn't have names for was absolutely an internalized, I wouldn't go so far as to say self-loathing, but a keen awareness that I was receiving messages of contempt from the world around me about where I was from and how much money my family didn't have.
And as you developed as a young woman, you were clearly bright. There's this really telling scene where you get identified as gifted and talented. Do you remember what it felt like at that moment, and then what it felt like within your family, how they reacted to that? Could you share that?
Sure. So, you know, I write in the book how that's in a chapter that's about a deep sense of the way that we kind of categorize our members of society into pat categories of good or bad. And often those who are on the losing end of the economic spectrum fall in the bad category for various reasons. And so I was used to people being evaluated for their negative aspects. And when a school psychologist pulled me aside and said, "We want to ask you a bunch of questions," it struck me as more like a criminal interrogation or something, and it turned out that it was this great blessing that may very well have changed the trajectory of my life, that she sent a folder home with me to tell my mom that that I had intellectual gifts that they wanted to pay extra attention to at school, and I wept when I read it on the sidewalk, because I'm from a culture of good, loving people, but it's a very stoic place where no one is giving out many pats on the back. And it was really the first time anyone had validated that part of who I was. If I'd been born into a more privileged family, you know, maybe that sort of validation would have come much earlier. But when I shared it with my family, you know, I think that they were proud, but it was also complicated. So my grandma, who largely raised me, left school in ninth grade to work. And so her association with just the institution of public education was not terribly positive. And so she was sort of simultaneously proud and a little bit suspicious of this system that was embracing me.
A great part of your book is you write a lot about the strong women in your life and the lessons that they were able to teach you that maybe you wouldn't learn if you had been born somewhere else. What are some of the valuable lessons that you think you learned from growing up the way you did that someone might not think you would get from your experience?
Well, you know, I write sometimes in both my journalism and this book about what I see as just the raw, organic, real, and often unnamed feminism of the women around me, and it was by necessity in some ways, because you can't live in an environment that hard where everyone is underpaid, and therefore if you're female on top of that, it's a twofold economic disadvantage, at least, not to mention if someone also faces racial barriers as a woman of color and so on. You have to believe that, you know, this most essential definition of feminism, that a woman and man are equal or deserving of equitable opportunity. You're not going to get very far on a given day at work if you don't hold that innate sense of your own worth, regardless of the messages that you get from the world. And the women that raised me were, you know, they might have physically appeared to the world as something that would be ridiculed as poor folks, but the way that they carried themselves was like queens, and I admired them deeply for that. And even though they never crossed a college campus or got a hold of the formative texts of feminism, but they just understood it in a way that I think is kind of undersung when we talk about women's rights and the women who get to be part of those conversations.
One of the things that's I think commendable in your book is that you discuss race, which a couple of other books haven't. And you wrote, "Our small town was almost entirely white, and in that context, economics decided the social order." As you went out into the world and you thought about race and you thought about the way you grew up and you thought about what it meant to be white and how people responded to you as a white person and then as a poor white person, what did you discover?
Well, you know, the challenging thing about perceiving racial privilege when you're in an overwhelmingly white place, and as you pointed out from the book, I was at the bottom of the socioeconomic pecking order in that context. The challenge there is that you might need more information or a bigger picture view about this country to understand the ways in which race has whiteness has privileged you. And by that I mean, you know, how did I come to be a fifth generation Kansas farm kid? Well, it had something to do with a federally sanctioned veritable genocide of indigenous peoples on that very land. What I came to understand is, and why there might be some value in, even though I resist the way that we have, that some media narratives often whitewash the working class that I know to be racially diverse, I do think there is some value in parsing out the white working class aspect, in that you can simultaneously have racial privilege and economic disadvantage. And in that very complicated conundrum, I think there are a lot of important conversations about this country to be had.
We're speaking with Sarah Smarsh about her book, Heartland. You know, a lot of obvious conversations have been had around urban versus rural. Why don't we understand each other? Blue versus red. And you wrote something interesting in this one passage that says, "City and country is a dichotomy that predates the United States by centuries. What's particular about Americans is the way we move along highways across big stretches of earth to the place we think will do right by us, the place where we hope we might belong." From your writing and from being in this culture and outside of this culture and going to big cities and living in big cities and coming home, how are we going to find a place where we all belong, where we belong together, where we get to be purple?
Oh my, what a important question. You know, I think that my being a writer, I'm biased, I suppose, on this answer, but I think story is one of the answers and one of the important bridges. There's no excuse in this moment where we can also readily connect through the now digital touchstones of our lives for us not to be reaching out to understand one another. And so, you know, we talk now about the bubbles that we exist in and the proverbial silos on social media or whatever, but it's like, you know, every place is a bubble. Okay, we might criticize New York as somehow roughly liberal and urban, but a small town, quote unquote, red state experience is a bubble of its own, and that's an inevitable aspect of human experience. I think that we need to come back to a place where we're not using language that reduces our people to monoliths and stereotypes, such as Trump country or even that red state, blue state dichotomy I just noted, and get back to nuance and complexity. I think we just need to kind of grow up as a country right now, and never more than now. Story is a way for us to feel, to remind ourselves that we have more in common than not in this particularly politically divisive moment.
And finally, I'm curious what your family thinks of the book, because you're very honest in this book. You talk about the domestic abuse. You talk about substance abuse. You talk about losing homes. You talk about teenage pregnancy. It's all there. It's all out there. How does your family feel about it? And how did you feel about it after you read it?
Well, I think that maybe because I was checking in with my family along the way, so during those many years of research and writing, I was seeking my immediate close family's blessing and consulting them for the information that really constructed a lot of the passages for which I wasn't even present. So maybe it's for that reason that we had a deep trust in the writing process, and they couldn't be prouder of the book. I know that it doesn't always play out so fortunately in the family experience of memoir, but a quick anecdote: my grandmother Betty, whose deepest, darkest secrets were revealed with her blessing in the book. You know, if anyone had a right to kind of freak out when it hit the shelves, it'd be her. And her response was just she read it front to back for the first time when it came out, and very generously said to me, "I'm so sorry that you struggled so much as a kid. I didn't realize it." And so that generous spirit is one of the great fortunes of the world I was born into, even if there wasn't much money going around.
It's a really interesting book. I think there's a lot to be learned from it. There's a lot to be learned about how the heartland got to be the way it is. A lot to learn about your family story, a lot to learn about being a woman in that situation. Sarah Smarsh, congratulations on the book Heartland, and thank you for joining us in all of it.
Thank you, Allison. This was so great.